This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When you're in the news business like I am, you get a lot of stories pitched to you from think tanks, organizations doing research on policy issues that they want you to publicize and talk about. Long ago, I realized that the idea of a nonpartisan think tank is really kind of a misnomer. All think tanks latch onto certain ideas and issues to try to help to shape the public's perception of them. Recently, our friend and political analyst Bill Curry, a longtime Democrat, came on our show and talked about how Republicans have taken the upper hand in thinking about politics, that the proliferation of conservative think tanks must mean that his party, the Democrats, are being left behind. Today, Where We Live, think tanks and their influence in American life. We'll talk about how they've changed since they first started back in the early part of the 20th century. We want you to join us. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll also take your emails, wherewelive@wnpr.org. First, I want to welcome in Robert Samuelson. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He wrote recently about the future of think tanks. He joins us by phone. Robert Samuelson, welcome to Where We Live.
Nice to be with you.
So I'm wondering what you think is causing a shift in think tank practices, as you write about, from being idea generators to institutions concerned more about following political agendas. Tell us about that shift in your mind.
Well, I've been a journalist in Washington since the late 1960s, and in the period that I've been here, if you go back to the early 70s, there were only a few large think tanks around. The Brookings Institution was generally considered a little left of center. The American Enterprise Institute was a little right of center. They tended to finance some major research projects, which could have been financed in academia, but they were financed by these think tanks. They might have some policy implications, but that wasn't the only or even the main purpose of the research. It was just to sort of create a new body of knowledge. If you go flash forward to today, we have dozens of think tanks in Washington, many on the left, many on the right, some very few sort of centrist. They produce an awful lot of material about policies and programs, but there's not as much, relatively speaking, genuine research into how government works or doesn't work, social trends, whatever. It's much more contemporaneous than scholarly.
And I'm wondering why this change and when it really did start to change, because as you say, even in the last few decades, when you started in journalism, it wasn't really like this. When the big change?
I think the change began in the sort of the late 70s and the early 80s, and I think it roughly parallels sort of the polarization of the political class, I think to some extent the success of the conservative ideas, supply-side economics in the late 70s and early 80s being a major example, energized people on the liberal part of the spectrum to sort of imitate what some of the conservatives were doing and to be much more aggressive in peddling policy solutions that came out of think tanks, as opposed to just what I would consider to be genuine research.
But let's talk about that. In your mind, the difference between genuine research and maybe some of the types of research that modern think tanks are doing, at the end of the day, people are going to want to know the answers to questions. But when you talk about think tanks trying to gain a new body of knowledge, are you talking about the germ of the idea they're trying to study, the questions they're basically asking, or are you talking about the end result, the product that they're creating at the end?
Well, I would say both, but let me just give you two examples of things that were done at the American Enterprise Institute, which I say is a sort of right-of-center think tank. In the late 70s, early 80s, they financed a study by Charles Murray called Losing Ground, which is a critique of the welfare system. But it was a full-length book. It was not a 20-page sort of policy brief. It broke a lot of new ground, and I think it influenced people's perceptions of how the welfare system worked. In the late 90s and early in this decade, AEI also financed a three-volume history of the Federal Reserve Board by economist Alan Meltzer, who's a conservative economist but a well-respected scholar. I don't think that would be financed today. It produces a lot of interesting stuff, but it doesn't sort of have a policy conclusion that you can sort of summarize in a page or two. And that's what I'm talking about.
We're talking today with Robert Samuelson. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He wrote recently about the future of think tanks, and we're considering think tanks and their influence in American public policy and life today on the show. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in also by phone Ken Silverstein, who's former Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. He's currently a senior investigative reporter at First Look Media. His e-book is called Pay to Play, Think Tanks, Institutional Corruption and the Industry Ideas, which he authored while he was a fellow at Harvard. Ken, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you heard from Robert Samuelson a bit of his take on how think tanks have changed over the time. Maybe you can give me some of your history here. How do you think it evolved to where we are today?
Okay. Before starting, I just want to make sure to say that I wrote this book while I was a fellow at the Safra Center at Harvard. And since I was funded by the Safra Center, I want to make sure that in addition to my other credits that I mentioned that. I agree with a lot of what Mr. Samuelson says, but I would go further because it's not just a partisan issue. It's not just a question of having Democratic think tanks and Republican think tanks. That's part of the problem. The Heritage Foundation is basically a sock puppet for the Republican Party. What they say is designed to enhance and advocate for the Republican Party. It's completely dishonest research. On the left, you have essentially the same situation with the Center for American Progress. You already know what they're going to conclude before they do the research because their agenda is set in a way that's designed to support the Democratic Party, and so the outcome is predetermined. So that's a big part of the problem. But it's not just the partisan think tanks that have been corrupted. It's across the board, from the most prestigious and nonpartisan think tanks, like the ones we think of as the gold standard, Brookings and Center for Strategic and International Studies and the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm not saying that every scholar at these places is tainted and that every product they produce is tainted, but the problem is they're all drumming up huge amounts of money, and they're getting most of it from foundations that may have political points of view, whether they may not necessarily be partisan, but, you know, they're political. They are getting the money from wealthy individuals and corporations. They do a very, very poor job of disclosing that. They don't like to really talk about that much. But all of these institutions, all of these think tanks, they actually have membership rewards programs like the airlines. So the more you give them, the more benefits you get. And this is across the board again. It's at Heritage, it's at Center for American Progress, but it's also at places like the Brookings Institution. So for example, Brookings, which everybody thinks of as one of the, you know, the most solid and reliable, has a four-tiered level of giving. And the top tier is called the Chairman's Circle. That's for donors who give $100,000 and up. And they advertise these. They don't advertise it very, very broadly, but if you're a donor, you get these rewards. So if you give $100,000 and up, you get, and I'm quoting here from their own brochure, a customized program of benefits designed in collaboration with the Senior Director of Corporate and Foundation Relations. And they also have a program leadership committee where the donors meet with senior think tank officials to discuss their specific goals. Quote, if you have a particular area of policy interest, you can support a specific research effort underway. And then they say those interested in a deeper engagement, which just is another way of saying giving more money, get personal briefings from resident experts and together draw up a research agenda that will, quote, maximize impact on policymaking. So they're saying the more money you give, the more benefits we'll give you. You can even help us draw up an agenda to maximize the impact on policymaking. So if you're a corporation, you can go to Brookings, and I don't want to just pick on Brookings. They all do it. I mean, almost all of – I can't say all, but everyone I've looked at has a donor program. And, you know, if you want to advocate for a policy. You go to a think tank because everybody thinks think tanks are, you know, gee, these are academic institutions. No, they're political institutions. You can go, and the beauty of it is you can give the money in secret. Think tanks do not have to disclose. Unlike politicians or even lobbyists who make political contributions, think tanks are unregulated, essentially. You can give money. The think tank doesn't have to disclose it. You don't have to disclose it. And the think tank essentially is serving, in many instances, as an unregistered lobbyist for private interest.
Well,
and this is across the board.
And I'm wondering, Robert Samuelson, if you can chime in on this. How much of an influence do you think that these corporate donations that Ken is talking about really, really contribute to the change in American think tanks and the way in which they operate?
Well, I don't know how much corporate or the donations of wealthy individuals influence the agendas, but I think he's essentially correct in the sense that all these think tanks are competing for funding. And so you get a kind of blurring of the lines between what used to be scholarship, independent scholarship, and sort of pushing an agenda. But I do think that what you get here is you get sort of a self-selection process. I mean, and I take his point that, which is really what I was trying to say earlier, there's less generation of new ideas and new sort of body of knowledge than there used to be, and there's more packaging for an impact. And in soliciting funds for support, the think tanks want to show that they're effective in influencing public policy because that is their goal. So you get this much more partisan and much more sort of pragmatic ethos than prevailed, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
And we're going to hear more from Ken Silverstein in just a moment. But Robert Samuelson, while I still have you and before we take our break, I guess I should ask, given all of this knowledge about how things have changed, about how partisan think tanks largely have become, about all of the donations that come in from wealthy individuals or corporations, should we in the news media, should we pay attention in the way perhaps we did in the past to some of the research coming out of these think tanks?
Well, my gut feeling is that when these think tanks are cited in the press, they're identified as being either liberal or conservative, and so that readers or viewers or whatever, they know what they're being exposed to. It's not as if people are trying to pull the wool over their eyes and claim that that they're completely nonpartisan or objective. So I don't think there's an awful lot of deception going on here, but I could be wrong.
Robert Samuelson's a columnist for The Washington Post. He wrote recently about the future of think tanks. Thank you, sir, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to continue with Ken Silverstein, who wrote Pay to Play Think Tanks, Institutional Corruption in the Industry Ideas. And we're also going to bring in the head of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, a local think tank here in Connecticut. We want to hear your ideas. 860-275-7266. What do you think about what comes out of think tanks in America today? Join us on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're thinking about think tanks and their influence in American public life and public policy. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We're joined on the phone by Ken Silverstein, who, while at the Harvard Safra Center, wrote extensively about think tanks and a pay-to-play industry. We're also joined in studio today by Carol Platt-Liebau, who is president of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, a Connecticut-based think tank. And I wanted to welcome you into the studio today. Carol, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
I'm wondering, first, before we get to some phone calls and bring some other people into the conversation, what your thoughts are about what you've heard so far in our conversation. The fact of the matter is people hear that think tanks are working on public policy ideas. But as our last guest just said, we always have before it, it's a conservative or a liberal think tank. Are those identifiers even appropriate? I mean, is that good enough for us to know that it's a conservative think tank or a liberal think tank, and then we'll make up our own mind as to whether or not we should listen to what you have to say?
Well, you know, I think sometimes these sorts of disclaimers may be necessary or appropriate. I'm not sure that they're always entirely helpful. For example, at Yankee Institute, we have ideas we believe in very deeply, but our goal is to be engaged in discussing issues that matter and finding common ground so we can all move forward together. We don't care where the good ideas come from. We're happy to work with Democrats or Republicans or anyone else. And I wonder whether some of the pathologies that Professor Samuelson and Mr. Silverstein have identified are more of a problem in the Capitol, inside the Beltway, when you're dealing with two highly polarized national parties, rather than out in the states where there are a lot of us who are just residents of Connecticut. We love our homes. We want our children to be able to stay. We don't want our grandparents to have to leave. And we are working hard to try and figure out ways to make life better for the people of Connecticut.
You know, Peter is calling from Stanford. I think he's got some of these same ideas. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yes. I was, you know, I don't visit Washington too much or too often, but the think tanks are like steps away, maybe a couple blocks away from the Capitol. And I'm wondering, if I, let's say, won office, and I was like a garden variety Democrat or a garden variety Republican, and I really wasn't quite sure of, you know, what the positions were or what the line was, what was the traditional role of think tanks? Would the congressman, like, walk over to the think tank, to the Brookings Institution? Oh, this is a liberal institution. Let me see what talking points I can get from them, or if I was a conservative. You know, I mean, is that what they tried? Is that the whole idea? Because, you know, these think tanks are like, you know, within walking distance of the Capitol.
Peter, you raise such an interesting point. And in Ken Silverstein, I wanted to get into a little bit more of the history of this, because I think many people in America might wonder what these idea generators were originally for. I think Peter makes a point that many of us think. You show up in Washington and you're a brand new congressperson, say, you don't know everything about all the policies that you might need to know about being a member of Congress. So you start to talk to really, really smart people who've done an awful lot of research on a wide range of things, and that's where you get some of your ideas. Is this part of a traditional idea of what a think tank should be, Ken?
It is part of the traditional idea. I do just want to emphasize, though, that we keep hearing from the guest that, you know, we're looking at a partisan situation where you've got liberal and conservative think tanks, and I can't emphasize enough, it's not just liberal versus conservative. It is across the board. Money is influencing the agendas and the outcome at these think tanks. It doesn't matter whether they're partisan or not. But, and I'd like to, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that later. But in terms of the history, think tanks were originally thought of. Brookings was the first think tank in the early part of the 20th century, and it had a different name then. But, you know, these were thought of as academic institutions that would conduct impartial research. And for a long time, they did something like that. Even in the 60s, American Enterprise Institute, which we now think of as being a right-wing, neoconservative think tank, because it is, used to, you know, it may have been on the conservative side, but there's a story that Tevi Troy, who himself is at a think tank, but he wrote a really interesting study about the history of think tanks. He talks about how AEI during the Nixon years, I think it was, did a study about a particular Pentagon plane and, you know, just to see whether it was cost-effective and what were the pros and cons. And they actually didn't even release it there was a vote coming up on whether to fund it or not. And they didn't want to basically try to influence the vote with their report. So they waited till after the vote before releasing it. You know, they thought of themselves, most think tanks, up until the 70s, really, think tanks, I think, thought of themselves as being academic institutions. But now the whole point is to influence politics. That's what the donors want, and that's the danger of raising money from, it's not just corporations, they're the very big donors, but foundations and individuals, too, who give money, and they want results. That's why they're giving the money. They don't want a fair and balanced, I'm sorry to use that term since it's been corrupted by Fox News, but they don't want a fair and balanced study. They want a study that will support their point of view, that then they can use with Congress or the State Department or whoever and say, see, we've got this think tank that says we've got, you know, that our solution is the best solution. So that's a big part of the problem, too. You know, you have a donor base that is increasingly activist and increasingly views think tanks as another component of their Washington lobbying activity.
Well, I just want to get
contributions. Yeah. You hire lobbying firms, and you retain the work. You retain think tanks.
I just want to get a quick comment from Carol, who's in the studio now. I know you wanted to jump in.
Well, I did want to jump in, and actually suggest that if people took a look at some of the state-based think tanks, that might be a very useful antidote to some of the understandable cynicism when you look at a lot of what goes on in Washington. Because in fact, the Yankee Institute isn't accepting money in exchange, you know, in exchange for espousing positions. We have certain things we believe. We're very transparent about what we believe. And then we invite anyone who agrees with what we believe and wants to help research and disseminate and help people understand those views to contribute to us. And so I do understand how in a city where, you know, the federal government is becoming ever larger, where there are more and more imperatives to try and influence the government because it has more and more power over so many details of businesses or people's lives, that people actually are looking for new ways to try and influence the government. But here in the States, I wish Mr. Silverstein would come up. He has a standing invitation. Come visit us at the Yankee Institute. Come see what we do. Come see what we are working on and why we believe what we believe. And, you know, the fact is that about 90% of our money comes from in-state donors. These are not big donors. And, in fact, we would not allow our policy agenda to be driven by the dictates of a donor, because if we did, we lose our integrity. And what's more, that integrity is our currency. And if we are ever going to be able to influence the public conversation, you can't do it once people know you're a hired hand.
Well, and I think that that's what Ken's really talking about, this idea of transparency. People know in Connecticut that the Yankee Institute is essentially a free market think tank. You have certain political ideologies, and that's what you work on. If people know, then you know. What he's talking about, I think in large part, is a lack of transparency, people not knowing where the money's coming from. Somebody else who's expert in this I want to bring into the conversation is James McGann, who's a senior lecturer of international studies and director of the Think Tanks and Civil Societies program at the University of Pennsylvania. He joins us by phone today. James McGann, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, so glad to be with you. It's a very interesting discussion. I've been listening closely to what everyone has said, and I think, you know, what I would suggest is, while this has been a very productive discussion on these issues, much as what has been raised focuses on a narrow set of issues such as funding transparency and disclosure, one group of policy actors or institutions, think tanks, and unfortunately is a flawed formulation of the issues and ignores the dramatic changes in funding, advances in technology, calls for donors to be more relevant and have what they describe as high-impact research. And this is also a call from policymakers and the public to be policy relevant. Lost in these discussions is the fact that more than 1,800 think tanks and 10,000 or more of scholars focus and are dedicated to the highest standards and are doing serious research that is policy-oriented, and they are trying to address the critical problems facing the U.S., which are real, in an environment where there is political paralysis and hyper-partisanship in terms of Washington and throughout the U.S. and, frankly, throughout the world. So the other important thing that's missed here is that every institution, because the U.S. focuses on, relies on, is at the inception of the Republic. When de Tocqueville visited the United States, he pointed out that there are independent institutions all trying to raise support and involve the citizens in it. It's unique to the United States. Nowhere else in the world Are there such independent institutions that are independently supported? No one would question in terms of a donor circle at a museum or at a nonprofit. So these questions do a great disservice to all of the dedicated institutions and individuals who work at think tanks throughout the U.S. and is really not, is focusing on a narrow set of individuals, not necessarily the situations that have been cited, are focused on individuals, not on institutions writ large. And they have a tremendous interest in focusing on making sure that these issues do not take place, because at the core, all they really have is their credibility.
But
if they lose that, they lose everything, and they need to protect it. So I have a little trouble with the formulation of both Samuelson and Ken in terms of the problem, because it doesn't really focus on the real issues in terms of money and politics. It doesn't focus on the real drivers, and it doesn't focus on groups like law firms, consulting firms, and advocacy groups, which are now the major drivers in what Ken is describing.
But I think one of the questions that we have is there a worry, James McGann, that these think tanks, which, as you say, have been put together to do this high-level research, and there's a lot of dedicated people doing this at the highest possible standards, is there a worry that because there's so much money in politics and there's so much money that is being driven toward all of these other actors in politics, that somehow the think tanks have been already or will be corrupted by this same money? It seems clear that with all this money in politics, this is yet another place where influence can cause problems.
Well, I think that what has already been pointed out, I mean, one, there's 1,800 institutions which cover the broad spectrum of virtually every political ideology and interest one could possibly conceive of, so that they counteract one another. And those in Washington, both in Congress, in the news media, and throughout the U.S., know where an institution sits on the political spectrum. So they're able to, if they're honest and focused, one, point that out, and as you're doing here and in every news program, you're looking at a range of opinions of people who are across the political spectrum, and that's very much a part of the American democratic experience. So I would also point out that if you look closely at these institutions, there are thousands and thousands of donors. And so in terms of the political process, one would, in terms of other countries, it's clear that there's one group that influences and determines policy. In the U.S., there's so much cacophony and so little coherence in our policy, it is not a major concern. That is not to say that I'm not concerned about transparency, and in fact have been dedicated for a number of years in improving both and ensuring the quality and integrity of public policy research. What I am concerned about is the focus exclusively on disclosure does not address the problem.
What the
focus should be on,
yes,
on, you know, moving to provide core support for these institutions.
And by
that would ensure what you are and others are pointing out as the problem. And there's a tremendous move in the last 20 years away from providing any core support for these institutions, and there are a whole set of other drivers.
Well, and when you say core support, where should that core support come from?
Well, historically, the major foundations and major donors in the United States provided institutional core support for the institutions. They have moved from that to what I call micro grants, that they don't even support a program, they don't even support a project, they'll support the book. And then the institution is forced to essentially raise the rest of the money to keep the lights on and support the scholars. So there are, you know, whole other drivers in terms of the intense competition, which is affecting journalism, and newspapers are going out and publishers are going out because of all knowledge-based institutions are threat by technological advances. So all of these create a very difficult situation, and the thing that's important to remember is we don't rely on or have major institutional things, because with the nature of our democracy, we look toward independent institutions. The 9/11 Commission is the best example of that. If you look at one of the most important policy issues facing America, most of the those who were involved in that process, who advised government, who government went to seek advice from, were from think tanks. And so this is an important group of institutions that need to be supported. And I agree that the base of their support is being eroded, and that is putting them in a difficult situation. But to blame them, to blame the victim in some respects for this problem is wrong. To focus on those institutions is wrong. There are bigger drivers that need to be addressed, and encouraging foundations and others to move back to providing core support for a number of the top institutions in the U.S. would be in the national interest and would help address more fundamentally this problem than has been the case thus far.
Ken Silverstein, we just have about a minute or so before our next break, but I'm wondering if you could just respond a bit to James McGann, also with the thought in mind of what can we really do to make this system better? We've talked about transparency, certainly. What can we do to actually make think tanks, the 1,800 or so that are working right now, a more useful part of American life, Ken?
Well, first up, every time I've written about think tanks, I have cited Jim or his institute, so I am a huge fan of his work, and he knows this issue better than anybody. I don't think we're in that much disagreement, really. It may be a question of emphasis. I do think, though, that the problem is, again, it's not just partisan. It's bigger than that. And you've got agendas. This issue of core funding is an important one, and Jim certainly would know better about solutions than I, so I will cede to him on that. But what he's saying sounds like a very good idea. But I think, you know, it's not just transparency. I totally agree with Jim about that. But when you're raising money, and these institutions, you're talking about institutions sometimes with $300,000 or $400,000 budgets and $400 million budgets. They're immense institutions. They are raising money the way politicians need to raise money. And it affects not just the outcome, but the agenda setting. You know, somebody pays for these events. Think tanks, when they go out, they're not just saying, hey, what are the most important issues of the day? Some of them are, of course, and sometimes I'm not trying to suggest that they're, you know, corrupt to the core, but, you know, if somebody comes in and says, hey, I want to study on such and such and I'll give you so much money, this is agenda shaping. I mean, think tanks make decisions on the basis of who's going to give them money for these projects, and, you know, they say, okay, sure, then we'll do a study on such and such. Again, not across the board. There are lots of great people at these think tanks, but I think Jim has probably hit upon the core issue, which is the funding, and how do you allow these institutions that should play an important role to be funded in a way that it doesn't impact or corrupt their agenda and their product.
And I think, James McGann, as a last word from you, maybe what we're talking about here is not at all an indictment of the think tanks that exist, but it's kind of an indictment of a lot of American life right now. If you're trying to do research at a university on anything, you have corporate influence. If you're trying to do my job in public media, you have people trying to influence you constantly. We seem to be in a world in which many corporations and many individuals increasingly feel as though they can shape things by contributing dollars. Maybe this isn't really just about think tanks, James McCann. This is about how American life has changed to make people think that they can influence a lot more with a couple dollars.
Well, I mean, part of it, the reality in one of these big drivers is that one would is the professionalization of philanthropy. In the past, pre-70s, most foundations essentially did not have large staffs, and the money was given to institutions, and they trusted the institutions. And the reality is that because there are people who are in the, whether it's in a college, whether it's in a museum or a think tank, they're there because they're dedicated to the purpose of the institution. They're not corrupt. They're not looking to play fast and loose. What they're dedicated and looking, having a staff that's looking to evaluate and to, you know, once you have a professional staff, they want to develop specific programs and creates what I call programitis. You know, they're doing the best next best thing that they, you know, will make a name for themselves, when in reality it really is a major problem because it erodes, it becomes so specialized that it erodes the support and the integrity of all institutions, not think tanks. And so trusting the institution and giving them the money, because donors really are neither the producers or users of the policy-oriented knowledge produced. And so donors often are interlopers. And especially in the knowledge-based industry, where you're trying to do and focus on the real problems facing America, it creates a significant distortion. That's not to sort of suggest that the donors are totally problematic. They all have good intent, but it's gone. My contention, which I've said for some time, is the pendulum has swung too far to micro grants and micromanaging institutions, and we really need to trust them and allow them to do the good work that they've dedicated their lives to do.
And we're talking about the work of think tanks in the program today. I want to thank James McGann, who's a senior lecturer of international studies and director of the Think Tanks and Civil Societies program at the University of Pennsylvania. I also want to thank Ken Silverstein, who's a former Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. He wrote a book called Pay to Play: Think Tanks, Institutional Corruption, and the Industry of Ideas, which he authored while he was a fellow at Harvard's Safra Center. Thank you both so much for your time. We're going to continue our conversation about think tanks with Carol Platt-Liebau, who's president of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're honoring Labor Day weekend with a conversation about the past, the present, and the future of work life in Connecticut. We'll feature some highlights from the Connecticut Humanities year-long Connecticut at Work program. We'll also take a closer look at the Smithsonian's traveling exhibition, The Way We Worked, which is on display now at the Nathan Hale Homestead in Coventry. You can join us for a conversation about work tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, we're talking about think tanks, their influence in American life. We've had a wide-ranging conversation so far about political influence in think tanks, the influence of corporate donors. We're talking now with Carol Platt-Liebau, who's president of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. We'll take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 and your tweets at Where We Live in just a moment. Carol, we sort of glossed over a little bit about the work that you do. Just explain to people what the Yankee Institute is.
Sure. The Yankee Institute is an institution, well, that is essentially engaged in trying to engage the public, educate the public in dialogue. Same with legislators, lawmakers, really anyone who will listen. We are independent. We want to be credible, and we have a commitment to trying to forward policies that will promote freedom and opportunity and fairness for all generations of the people of Connecticut.
So parse out freedom, opportunity. What does that mean exactly? Explain exactly what
sure.
you're talking about.
Well, what I'm talking about is for example, limited government, free market policies that we believe are the best way to promote prosperity and ensure fairness. And so, you know, part of what we do is we do have policy studies that we create and that we disseminate. And one of them, for example, has to do with the taxes and fees in Connecticut. And it just is a study of the taxes and fees. And it points out that we have 200 taxes in this state that produce only $25.2 million of revenue. That's 0.001% of the entire tax collection, and yet no one knows how much it costs to collect these taxes. No one has any idea. So it could well be that it's costing more to collect them than they're actually bringing in. And if that's the case, shouldn't we think about a more intelligent, more common sense policy for seeing about what kind of revenues we want to raise and how we want to do it?
So just give us, in that instance, for instance,
sure.
Tell us a little bit about the idea generation here, because we talked earlier about what think tanks traditionally were meant to do. I mean, you're trying to build a new body of knowledge about,
yes.
about policy. But explain where you start from. I mean, are you essentially saying, look, we're looking at ways to have lower taxes here in Connecticut, and so this is an idea of what we can study that will get people talking about lower taxes in Connecticut? Or are you starting from another place? Explain that to me.
Oh, sure. You know, I think to answer that question, the better example is actually our recent study on our pension debt problem. And we wanted to study the pension debt problem because what we came to realize is that the $24.5 billion obligation that the state talks about is actually much larger. And that in point of fact, every child that's born in Connecticut comes into the world with $27,668 of pension debt. Now, that's a concern. And the increasing chunk of the state budget that these pension obligations are occupying are the reason, as we look at our state budget, why we wanted to study this, get a handle on the problem, and try and come up with a better way to address the problem that would protect the legitimate obligations of state employees as they retire without bankrupting the state or causing taxes to climb to such a degree that you end up driving out families, driving out the people who can actually pay the tax revenue, because as we all know, the wealthy are the most mobile people of all. They just move to another state, as we saw with a bunch of Californians leaving for Nevada, and ways that we can actually make a common sense contribution to discourse here. We came up with a solution that one policy that legislators really ought to be giving serious consideration to is switching to a defined contribution system rather than a defined benefit system. That would bring state government in line with their counterparts in the private sector, but it would also do a lot to begin working down this enormous pension debt that otherwise threatens that down the road we will have some kind of economic catastrophe or that we won't be able to keep the promises that we've made to the people who have served in state government.
So talk a little bit about how the ideas that you are working on are disseminated to, say, lawmakers. Because here in this state, I think we can all acknowledge that most of the important positions of power are held by Democrats.
Right.
The state legislature is run by Democrats. But even given that, when I talk to plenty of state Republicans, they don't have as their headline issue a lot of the things that you're talking about right there. I guess I'm wondering what the method is for you to get your ideas across to politicians who may try to implement them, who may try to get legislation passed. Are you talking with a lot of people who identify as conservative? Are you also reaching out to and talking with people who maybe identify as liberal or progressive at the same time? Just talk a bit about that.
Absolutely. We will talk. We want to engage in discourse with anyone who is sincerely committed to making the lives of the people of Connecticut better. And we don't care what party they are. And in fact, we have worked very productively with people across the aisle. For example, Senator Fanfara, a Democrat, took our taxes too small to keep brochure, this one that we were just talking about, this study, and he introduced legislation to study how much, in fact, all these taxes costed to collect. Because we know that they bring in some minuscule percentage of the state budget, 0.001%. I hope I made that clear before. But we don't even know how much it costs to collect them.
So how are we going to figure that out? So let's take the next step and this public policy issue. Let's say we figure that out. And let's say it actually doesn't cost all that much to collect. It's not a really big deal.
Well, I mean, then that's up to policymakers. And if that's what we find, then we would probably have some policy recommendations on that end. But the fact is that what we are trying to do is also avoid this whole specter of nuisance taxes. And, you know, the question of whether actually it costs more to collect than they bring in has a great deal to do with whether they're legitimate sources of revenue or whether they're just nuisance taxes. And some of them are so petty that they probably deserve their own independent evaluation. I mean, for example, did you know, John, if you want to start a business in this company, in this state, the first thing you and your company have to do before you've earned a dollar is just go and spend $250, pay the state to get a business license.
So just in the debate the other day, and every time he talks about it, Tom Foley, who's a Republican running for governor, talks about this business entity tax. It's $250, that is something that many conservative politicians have brought up. One way to think about that is Is $250, is that going to drive people out of business? Yes, it may be a nuisance. Yes, it might not be the best public policy. But is that truly going to drive companies away from Connecticut to go across the Massachusetts, New York, or someplace else?
Well, of course not. I mean, $250. But the fact is that it isn't going to drive United Technologies out of here. But if there is a small business woman, someone who thinks, gosh, you know, I think I have a skill. I would like to try and deploy this skill to either earn a living for my family or supplement my family's income. And she thinks the first thing I have to do here is go in, pay $250 just for the right to try. And there's another state and she's able to move it. You know, she doesn't have family here maybe, or maybe she just thinks she's got it. There are other states that make it a lot easier for people to go ahead and earn a living for their family and be productive and sort of help reach their dreams. Now, I mean, again, this, in my view, this business in and of itself, you know, it is what it is. It's $250, which for some people is quite a chunk.
Sure.
But, you know, it also is emblematic, I think. And I think perhaps this is the reason it comes up. I can't speak for anyone but us. But one of the reasons we talk about it is to us, it's emblematic of a mentality on the part of the state government of, in a sense, hostility to people who are simply trying to get out, make a living, pay their taxes, do what's right. And here the state is inhibiting that process rather than encouraging it.
So what happens, and we just have a few minutes left here, but what happens when you have a premise or an idea, something that you
sure.
want to study about how much taxes we take in and how state government uses that money? And then you look at it, you look at it closely and say, you know what? That actually works pretty well. It makes sense to spend this much money on that because that's something that we need to do. How do you handle findings that, frankly, just do not align with your overall premise of what you're trying to do?
Well, obviously, then we stop advocating for whatever specific policy initiative. You know, we've been – I mean, if we found out that these taxes that, you know, again, are just a minuscule part of the budget, if we found out that – indeed, you know, it costs, say, nothing to collect them, then I think the conversation switches. And then you have to look at whether the 0.001% of what it brings in, the $20 million it brings in, whether it's really worth the aggravation and the pettiness and all the rest of the associated bureaucratic problems that all of this brings up. You have to reconsider. I mean, again, we're not here just to be dogmatic. We're not here just to be ideologues. Our genuine number one concern is helping to influence the conversation and shape state policies that truly are going to be of benefit to Connecticut's people. If there is something that we thought that perhaps it isn't the way we thought, that's why we do the study. And we allow our policy recommendations to be based on the results. We don't allow our results to be driven by the policy recommendations we want to offer, because that's the only way you can be a think tank of integrity. And we believe our ideas are good. We believe that they will improve people's lives. And so we're not afraid of going and finding the facts, because if the facts don't bear us out, that's not the right policy for the people of Connecticut. We haven't had that problem, but if we did, that's the way we'd manage.
It's an interesting conversation about how think tanks think. Carol, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
John, it's been a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Carol Platt-Liebau is president of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Got a few tweets. John says, the problem is that politicians listen to politically motivated think tanks instead of listening to their constituents. And we also got an email from a listener that says, the most important think tank is an informed electorate, which gets out and votes. You can continue the conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.